Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books. My guest is Rosie Walsh, who's out with her brand new novel, Ghosted. In this book, Sarah meets Eddie, love at first sight. Seems like it's the type of love that each one of them has been waiting for their entire lives. We've all been there, right? After a week together in the beautiful English countryside, Eddie leaves on a vacation that he's been planning for quite some time. He promises that he will call Sarah, but he never does. Sarah's friends tell her just to forget about Eddie, but she can't, and she tries to figure out why Eddie has disappeared from her life. She knows there must be a reason for it, and there is. It's a love story. It touches on grief, mental health, forgiveness, but I'm going to leave it there because I don't want to spoil anything about this terrific read. Rosie, let's start with the title, Ghosted. When I used to hear the term, I would think of a ghost-written manuscript, but that word has taken on an entirely new meaning in modern times. What does it mean to be ghosted in a relationship?
I believe the definition of ghosted is to cut off contact without any explanation, and quite suddenly too. It wasn't a word I was that familiar with either, actually. The book has a different name in the UK, but it seems to be a term that everyone, certainly not just millennials, uses in the States. However you look at it, though, it's a pretty awful practice, but something that I think most of us have been through.
Well, you mentioned about the other title, and I did find it interesting. In the UK, this book was titled The Man Who Didn't Call, and by the time it makes it across the pond, Ghosted was the title. What was the impetus for that title change?
The book was always going to be called The Man Who Didn't Call, because obviously I'm a British author, and you know, I wrote it initially for a British audience. But when we were talking about submission in the States, my US agent, Alison, said, we can't call it that. It sounds like a Hitchcock film. It won't work. She said, I suggest we call it Ghosted. And I had to look up the word ghosted online because I had no idea what she was talking about. And I thought, no, that sounds like a sort of millennial dating term. That doesn't feel like a good match for this book at all. But she was absolutely certain. And actually, as with most things, I think most writers eventually have to trust their agent's instincts. And I think she got it right, actually, because, you know, the buzz that I've seen online has been really positive. And people of all ages seem to really understand what it means. Certainly not just young people, which is, I guess, what I feared.
I didn't think about the Hitchcock connection, but you're right. The Man Who Didn't Call does sound like a Hitchcock movie title. He's popular in the UK, though, right?
Tremendously so. And I think that's why it works in the UK. But I don't know. I guess, you know, Hitchcock films, marvelous as they are, you know, somewhat dated and not really consistent with the kind of book that I've written. Well, I'm not sure it would have been a great match.
You've written four other books under the pseudonym Lucy Robinson. Why was it now time to put your own name on this one?
Well, it's a good question, actually, because I never planned to change my name. I came up with the idea for this book, assuming that I would publish it as Lucy Robinson. The moment I sat down and started writing it, though, everything had changed, and I don't know why, because it wasn't something I planned. Everything about my writer's voice, the story itself, everything seemed different. I guess a bit more grown up, more lyrical. And I sent 30,000 words to my agent, and she called me, even though she has very little time, and said, now listen, I think we need to talk about this. She said, I think this is time. This is the one that we should put out under your own name. I think this feels so different. This just makes perfect sense to do it now. And I was a little unsure, I guess, because, you know, in my head it was always going to be a Lucy Robinson book. But, the further I got into my manuscript, the more I realized that, yes, this novel is absolutely from my heart. And therefore, it would have been wrong not to put my own name next to it. So I'm really glad we did, actually, because I just feel so proud coming out with this as my first novel.
We've all been there in a relationship where you meet someone and you think you're hitting it off, and then you don't hear from them, or they decide to break it up. It's awful. But what's going through Sarah's mind in the book as she experiences this fate at the hand of Eddie?
I think, the important thing about Sarah is that she's not 18, and, you know, the pain of heartbreak or ghosting, you know, when you're 18 is no less important than the pain of, you know, a woman who's 38, which is Sarah's age. I think she, at that age, A, doesn't expect to be ghosted. I think she assumes that men by that age will have more respect, will not be so cowardly or so rude, or so cruel, actually. But I think what really shocks her is the extent of her feelings. The fact that she'd been married for 17 years and had never actually felt this emotionally engaged with her husband. And I think the fact that, you know, in this modern day and age, we can very quickly find out what's going on online, you know, if we have been ghosted. We can ascertain very quickly whether or not that person's dead. And she does, you know, she knows he's not dead. And I think for Sarah, the real shock is not just that he's disappeared, but the complete loss of control that she experiences emotionally when she realizes that he's not going to contact her. And I think for any woman who's, you know, or man who's been ghosted sort of past the age of, I don't know, roughly 30, I think for most of us it is a terrible shock. We expect ourselves to have better self-control, better self-esteem even. And so for her to find herself kind of stalking him online and, you know, looking for him around London and doing all of the crazy things that she does, I think she finds that really humiliating and quite frightening.
Well, and I guess I put myself into her shoes, and I would think that if that happened to me, I'm thinking, my God, why am I doing this? Why do I need this person? What was it that Sarah thought was her need to have this person and essentially, like you said, lose control of her own emotions here? Her emotions were completely dictated by the behavior of Eddie.
Yes, they are. And, you know, ghosting is something I've experienced too, and that loss of self that Sarah experiences is something that I had too. You know, I remember being appalled by myself, you know, the kind of things that I was getting up to, trying to track him down, but and yet being unable to stop. I just think it's a kind of experience that we don't expect to have as an adult. And yes, obviously, there could be a million reasons, but I think the reason why I wrote a novel rather than this just being another, you know, another story you've heard about one of your friends experiencing, I wanted to investigate that 1% of times in which there actually is a really good reason why they haven't called. And I think it is probably only about 1% of times because, of course, you know, 99% of the time, it's just that they're being cowardly. They're not interested. They've changed their mind. You know, something's happened. They've met someone else. And rather than deal with the emotional fallout of ending a new relationship, they've just decided to be cowardly.
Well, I got the feeling as I read the book that this story probably came from an experience that either you had or a friend had or something that you'd read about. Am I close?
Yeah. I mean, I've been, luckily, I met a man who did call, so we've been together for nearly 10 years. Of course, it happened to me, but the thing that precipitated the writing of this novel was a dinner with a female friend. And just to set the scene, this woman is beautiful and very successful, very intelligent, emotionally intelligent, you know, very stable woman. She was in a new relationship with a guy. They were talking about going on holiday together, talking about her meeting his kids. And suddenly he disappeared off the face of the earth. And I was listening to her. She was sort of talking about, oh, you know, maybe he's lost his phone and maybe he's just really ill. And, of course, I was nodding along because I've been there and, you know, I know that those lies that we tell ourselves rather than face the possibility of, you know, the fact that we've just been ghosted. And I felt so furious that a woman like her was having to experience this at the age of 42. And I got home and I emailed my agent and I said, I want to write a book about this. And I said, but, of course, it's going to be about that one in a million occasions on which actually there really is a good explanation, and it's the journey of the book will take us. Most of the book is about Sarah's attempt to find Eddie.
We're talking with Rosie Walsh about her new novel, Ghosted. It's available now wherever your fine books are sold from the good folks at Viking. Rosie, the descriptions of the English countryside, as I read them, made me feel like I was physically there. How did you capture the scenery so effectively through written word?
Thank you. So the valley in which the novel is set is in an area of outstanding natural beauty in the UK called the Cotswolds, and it's where I grew up. I didn't grow up in that precise valley, although my best friend did, so I spent a lot of time there, and I've always had a very special feeling about that valley. There's a bit in the book where Sarah talks about how it feels like the valley feels kind of like a back pocket into which lots of secrets have been shoved, like ticket stubs. But to make it so vivid, I spent an enormous amount of time there. I went there probably 30, 40 times over the 2 years that it took me to write the book. And sometimes I'd go quite literally to smell the air, to see what was growing in the hedgerows, to listen to the bird song. I even camped out wild there without a tent one night with my boyfriend, just because I wanted to create the most multi-sensory picture possible of that very precious piece of landscape. Because when we first meet Sarah and Eddie, they're lying out there under a darkening sky, and, you know, they really have fallen in love. It's just before he disappears. And I wanted readers to be really invested in that. And I think the landscape around them is so fundamental to their love story that I just thought, right, I'm going to camp out there without a tent. It was quite an experience.
I think I can ask this question without giving anything away about the book, but how much research did you do about clown doctors?
Oh, quite a lot, actually. I'd never heard of Clown Doctors before writing this book, and I knew that I wanted Sarah to be involved with something charitable to do with children, ideally children in a sort of medical setting. And I started vaguely looking at hospital entertainers, but it didn't quite feel right. And that's when I stumbled across Clown Doctors. And I spent some time with a Clown Doctor charity in Scotland, although there's Clown Doctor charities all over the world, many in the States. In fact, it's in the States that it all started. And my mind was blown by what these practitioners can achieve in only a short bedside visit to, you know, to a sick child. It's part of the charitable sector that I really like to, you know, try and get involved with going forward, because actually the difference to a child who's so frightened and so exhausted and so used to, I think so many kids, you know, who are in hospitals are so used to not really having control of their bodies anymore, to somehow to then have a visitor by their bed who's been really stupid, really goofy. That's the first time in possibly months, even years, when that child actually has a higher status and is in control of somebody else. And that's the most incredibly powerful thing to witness. It was an absolute pleasure and an honor, really, to see these guys at work and to see the kids who they were helping. It's something I'll never forget.
Sarah and Eddie's families play key roles in this story. And as a writer, how do you strike a balance between including too much or not enough about ancillary characters?
That's another good question. For me, ancillary characters are something that I take very seriously. I don't like having characters that are just there to sort of serve a purpose or deliver a piece of plot. So the way I go about it is to deliberately overwrite them, and their story interferes way too much with the main story in my early drafts. And then gradually, once I've got them, you know, really firmly established, I shave them out layer by layer so that they're only doing what they need to. But by that point, you know, they're really rounded characters with, you know, important lives of their own. And I think that's something that, you know, means a lot to me as a reader, which is why it's something that I take so seriously as a writer.
Are there certain works of art that you've encountered over the years, not necessarily books, but that you still turn to as a writer for inspiration as you sit down to write?
Yes, and for me it's normally classical music. It's difficult because I can't have any music playing when I'm writing, but when I'm stuck, I will flick through my collection. And I think the thing for me that classical music does is it connects me with my emotional self. It's, you know, because we all get disconnected from emotional selves with these busy lives we lead, and nothing can reconnect me with my sort of emotional core, without wishing to sound silly, like classical music. One of my novels that I wrote under my pseudonym was about opera, and I listened to opera throughout. In fact, it's one of the only times I've been able to write with music in the background. And it had a really profound experience on me, effect on me even, when I was writing it, and really sort of steered the storyline. And certainly with Ghosted, I listened to all sorts of classical music when I was trying to really connect with the emotional storylines I was writing.
Well, this novel, I just can't say enough good things about it. I loved it, and every time I thought I knew where it was going to go, I was wrong. So you gave me about two nights of being wrong as I read. The book is Ghosted. It's a novel by Rosie Walsh. It's available now wherever you find books are sold from the good folks at Viking. Rosie, fantastic offering. Thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Brian.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.